Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 118, a special episode featuring a symposium conducted at the 2024 annual meeting of the Academy of Management held in Chicago. The symposium was titled Design Choices, Examining the Interplay of Organizational Structure and Digital Technologies, and was organized by Adrienne Baer and Amanda Pratt from Stanford University, along with our own Pedro Monteiro, who also moderated the session. This is part one of the episode where we present the opening comments and moderated discussion. To learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. The audio has been edited for clarity and brevity, and some portions have been re-recorded.
Thank you. So if we have more questions prepared, but we wanted to hear from you, right? So we can continue posting questions, but we thought it would be the opportunity to start to say if anyone wants to, pitch in, contribute, ask a question. Oh, yeah, so great. So we're going to go to the ones that want. Philip, you raise your hand first.
Sure. Thank you, panel, and your organization. It's awesome. It's good together. So my question sort of builds on a comment that Melissa made a little while back. This idea of connecting the org chart to the algorithm. And I've been talking a lot to video game designers who design roles, they design trajectories, experiences. I've been thinking a lot about this integration of not maximizing efficiency necessarily, not maximizing these things, but maximizing the experience so that you get people gamified into this world. So I was wondering if you guys could maybe think about maybe video game design, urban planning. Are there other fields that could maybe have some insights? Because we're looking at management and computer science, and video game design is computer science, I suppose. But that may have been integrated with these things before or might in the future. Any thoughts?
Well, that's such a cool idea. And I think you're asking for an expansive imagining. So I would love to, open that to everyone. The only thing that I'm going to say that made me think of is Julian Clement at Stanford JSB, right? Like does a lot of, he deduces org theory from video game design, like the roles and the coordination and stuff like that. So I think there is a lot to learn from there. It also reminds me, Jerry always tells a story about Pokemon. Like how Pokemon will get flash mob. Like so you're in Central Park and all of a sudden everybody's at the gym. So it seems like another example of the interplay between it. But
I have nothing interesting to add.
I keep telling your stories.
Thank you for your service. I have two good thoughts on that. One is I love game design is fascinating because they are trying to create worlds. There's a few other worlds that come to me that I think people are trying to create are classroom management. Like teachers have roles and they have strategies and they have goals. I think that's an interesting, you can tell my thing is what can we learn from other disciplines? So I think learning sciences might have something to say here that could be great. The other thing that kind of, now I'm caught on this sales pitch idea and I'm hearing you talk about experience design. As designers, we talk about experience. It is a point of pride to not, majority of people do not talk about designers do not talk about economic gain. They talk about experience. And I'm having this very cynical moment hearing you talk about experience and saying we all know that the product has to sell. Like if you design something that has a fabulous experience, but it doesn't sell, you're out of a job. So I'm just thinking about the stories that designers tell themselves. Is experience a euphemism for selling?
I think for the long sale, problem is, if you design to sell versus design to keep the user going, they're two different things, right?
But I don't know. One of the big critiques on things like Facebook, and there's this design for engagement, right? How do we keep people engaged as long as possible? so they don't spend their attention or money elsewhere, right? I mean, that's the implicit argument. So
is that not what we do with workers?
What we do with workers? You mean in the workplace?
Yeah.
Oh, to empower them, yes.
They engage and keep them going.
Keep them going, yeah. At the expense of what?
Can we cold call Lindsay to talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Think about slot machines. I mean, I think all of work is a game. Either it's signed by the organization, so that's, I feel like, more gamification, or the whole Norway workplace games thing. So, yeah, I agree. There's a lot of parallels between the video game side and how do you get control.
What part is this, just to bring it really concretely, what are we doing right now? What's the analogy in video games? What is the slot machine we are experiencing right now? Why are we all in this weird room talking with each other?
Let's just do it because she's our advisor.
Okay, so she was told to be.
Liz is a designer.
Something about intellect. I think like the joy of intellect or learning or when you go back and forth, you kind of get that higher, that desire.
Okay.
I think that's similar to when you're pulling the lever back of the slot machine and you're looking for the numbers to come up. That's what we're getting.
I think it's
particularly if this is a panel, and a panel is very different than, you know, a typical symposium set up. Just watching you and the banter and the keeps us involved.
We're having fun. Yeah, it makes me think of, I think some of your work makes me think of this as well. There's like knowledge workers, I think, are more likely to get gamification that seems fun. And like the rhetoric is around fun. It's more like normative control through gamification and fun. And then I think I have seen examples in companies I've studied where like I'm doing like big square quotes, like low status remote workers who are like, whatever. Like the gamification is more coercive and more like exploitative. You can see examples of that. So it seems like, I don't know, I forget where we went with this, but we as academics are in knowledge work right now. So we pretend like everything's really fun and like intrinsically motivating.
That's me in an
Can you say, so this is Lindsay Cambridge, you should be on this panel, and in your brilliant work on the ride-hailing industry, do drivers experience the sort of the pull, keep going, one more, and you get this, like, do they experience it as fun, like, in the same way that knowledge workers do, as Melissa was saying, like, do they think of it as fun the way that a video game is, and they keep doing it, or do they experience it as something else, but more compulsive, but not necessarily fun.
That's why I do have a real question. But there's a difference between gamification and workplace games. So gamification is organization design, which is what you're getting at, versus games, which are worker design. And then I find that's closer to Burroway. Burroway finds that lawyers play games, unemployed play games, IT programming, probably Kunda play games. But there's a game that we were talking about, Brian Gillen, which is a relational game, which is like, I want to make friends with you. So you put in anybody's car and they have snacks, or they decorated with unicorn decals, or there's a party car with strobe lights. All pictures are in my field sites. They are trying to make you happy. So that's a game that they feel very positive about, but it's also very much in alignment with the algorithm management system and all the tracking and the rating.
Right.
The other game is called the efficiency game, and that's where I'm all trying to make as much money as possible. So if the driver is not talking to you, they see you as a fare, not as a human being.
Oh.
And they probably have signs telling you, like, don't eat, don't drink, don't touch anything in my car. Again, more pictures that you can find in my paper. But there, the algorithmic management system isn't designed in a way to help them win the game. There's so much opacity and pricing. Mm-hmm. So there they feel like, oh, I can beat it if I keep enough log books and I've tracked my hours. But they ultimately never win that game.
Mm-hmm.
So two different types of games.
That's what we wanted, right? Have more of a conversation.
Yeah.
But let's go back to what Felipe said in a second. We were asking about urban planning, right? And when Jerry arrived, we noticed that we were in a room with a window, and there's the architecture of Chicago, and we were talking about a book by Mark Millen that I never read, but I had it, but I would do someday on aesthetics, how scientific management was so set of aesthetic ideas that, you know, Elena can't be here, but she has written about that with Java, who is here, right? So it's understanding that the stat is also a dimension, maybe, of the design. But the gentleman there, is it Usman?
Yes. I almost lost my train of thought because I got involved in what Lindsay was saying. But anyway, you know, I used to work for EDS that you may have heard of, which is now HP, and I don't know why that acquisition was so loved by everybody. But with that, I was able to go to multiple countries. And so what I would say is that, you know, organizations are a changing phenomena, and so are the software designers.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to the sales issue, I don't know if you remember that Lee Kuan Yew, when he was alive, said that Singapore is so small, we are not going to be manufacturers. We are going to be the second largest exporters of software after Microsoft. He put that vision. But, of course, India and US defeated that vision because we know what happened and all the investment went there. However, in Singapore, you can never imagine somebody developing and overselling the software. It is so well tested and I would say foolproof before you sell it. They will even tell the customer, hey, go away if you're impatient. Here though, there is a lot of this overselling, and you know, we were equally guilty in EDS. You know, people were coming to us and you know, what do you think about SAP? My first thesis was on SAP when it was so small. And I went to Germany, and also there was an apartment office in Philadelphia where they started.
Wow.
And Stu Mandlik sent me there to go look at them. And so I saw that, you know, there was overselling going on.
Yeah.
And every CEO wanted SAP yesterday.
Yeah.
And I said, wait a minute, but you know, our thesis is saying that they've not finished it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But you're buying a promise, which is an overpromise,
mm-hmm.
rather than the reality. So the two points, you know, I would like to have your thoughts on. One is about this cultural shifts in
mm-hmm.
how software engineers or designers versus organizational ethicists work together. And the second is about all this change that is happening in terms of, and how do you know, we are balancing two kind of, you know, balls at the same time. It's not just, you know, let's go and study only the designers and that will teach us, but they are influenced by that very culture.
Mm-hmm.
We at EDS were developing software at the request of
mm-hmm.
and at the behest of our clients.
Right on. So how do we think about the ethicists and the design of the interactions?
Well, what was your sales point that, you know, different cultures.
Oh, different cultures.
Yes.
Yes.
Define completion, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Different ways.
I appreciate that. And I should have qualified that I was speaking of the U.S. because I completely agree. The immediate thing that comes to my mind is the design of the maternal leave policy in the U.S., which figures that women need 3 months to have a child and then can get right back to work, whereas in Europe it's a year, and there's not even a question. I mean,
yeah,
I talk
yeah.
to my European friends, and they're like, "What? Nobody's ready after 3 months." Hell yeah, that's right. I am struck by what norms are set in different cultures, and I think the norms say a lot about how we value humanity and the human experience and relationships. If we value them as really intentional and, to be profited, relationships are to be profited, or are they to be supporting deeper human values? I think we have very different stands on that.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that play out in our US politics. Probably shouldn't have gone there, but did.
I think it's a great point. And I'll just say Silicon Valley, right? We had Theranos. That happened. Sam Bateman, like, that happened. Bitwise just went down. So we have a real problem in Silicon Valley.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt here. There was a firm in San Francisco called Collab.net,
mm-hmm.
Collaborative Software Development, in San Francisco, which was talking about this, and I'm talking of 2001. And the venture capitalists, of course, pulled them. Like, they were not able to develop the collaborative thing that they had kind of envisioned. I was on their advisory board, and I was saying that, look, don't do this thing. And of course, Silicon Valley said, no way, nothing is coming out of this thing. And I said, you know, there are some scientists, they were trying to understand and balance this. And they said, no, we don't have that kind of a patience. And it's that, CollabNet.
Lindsay, another question?
I did. So I'm going to ask the direct question about capital T theory, particularly when we're thinking about, like, you know, variety of uberization. You know, I'm familiar with the Bella and Rahman piece, and it's like political economy explaining why Uber is different in different countries. But I mean, like, you would expect there to be variation. Like, think about Pam's work in urbanization centers, or Disney World looks different in Paris than in Tokyo. I guess I'm asking for myself, like, how do we theorize beyond, like, yes, there are differences, like, where does it hook to? And also, similar to asking the question about org charts and algorithms, like, where does that, empirically it's interesting, but where does it find up?
I could pop off a little bit. The we often go into, so you said organizational science isn't really a science.
Yeah, I stand by that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And partly it was sort of, I was on a clarifying panel yesterday. Organizations are not natural objects. They're constructed objects that we then run regressions on. Like if you said we're going to have a science of diesel trucks and we're going to have conferences and papers with regressions and replications and we're going to look at like engine displacement and color and, you know, how tall is it, how much does it weigh, and what's it mileage, just some of them are dependent variables and others are independent. You run a bunch of regressions. It's like the thing that you learn when you get your first version of Stata, you know, like you get a bunch of data and then you say, oh, it's the science of diesel trucks. People would just point and laugh and say, what are you thinking? There's not a science of, like, it's a designed object and treating it as if it were out there. So I think there's something to that. But I would say if we needed something that rhymes with what we do, it would be natural history. So if you say a meteor hits the Earth, it's going to kill off the dinosaurs. And some other stuff is going to rise up in its place and say, well, what's going to give me the most insight into why this kind of species pops up in the Galapagos and this is in Canada and, you know, cacao is in Côte d'Ivoire? Like, how do we understand the species that evolve and then create a context for other species to evolve? And so I know it's a cliche analogy, but natural history seems like a pretty good way to think about the evolution of organizational forms in different contexts, and it fits with the institutional terroir ideas. Like, and so when you're characterizing the terroirs, like how much oxygen, rain, sunlight. I was in Colorado recently, and one side of the valley, it's all conifers because they don't get as much sun, and the other side is all aspen trees because they get lots of sun. And aspen trees are nitrogen fixers, and they're good for the soil, and they create this space where lots of animals can live. Conifers drop this acidic stuff, and nothing can live there. It's like, oh, two sides of the valley, but we've got an. I don't know if it counts as theory, but we can point to what are the factors that lead to these characteristic differences, and at least give us some handholds on getting at the phenomenon. Does it count as big theory? Maybe not, but I think it gives us some orienting constructs to think about how do these things work. I don't know if that's satisfying or not, but that's as far as I can get. There's a few things. How do you raise money for the business? Is it venture capital? Is it rich relatives? Is it banks? Is it online crowdfunding? And you can use revenue share agreements, which are really different and give different rights. Okay, that's one thing. How do you connect with labor? What's legal to call an employee versus not? So it doesn't make strong predictions. It just says, here's the right things to look to help make sense of why does Uber look that way in the US, but not in other places.
Can I go follow up on that?
Because I
think there's not like a right answer here, but it's interesting to think together about this. So I just wanted to share something in case if folks haven't read it. There's a monograph by a professor named Roger Bone, who was at HBS and now he's at UCSD. And the monograph is about, surprisingly, like gun manufacturing, but it's called From Art to Science. And I like this monograph because it looks at how much kind of subjectivity there is in something like manufacturing at the start when it is an art. And then over time, as more measurement is introduced into it, and then it can be, and then it becomes like a science. And again, I'm scare quoting all over the place here, but it becomes a science when there are a lot of variables that are measured, controlled, optimized, and then standardized. And that's when something tends to move into like mass production. So I'm not this much of a positivist. I can be very like interpretive as much as anyone here, I'm sure. But in terms of just like how I do my job, like I sort of think of theory as on that spectrum of like art to a science, and like how many of your variables are like very open and subjective versus how many of your variables do you have kind of tightly controlled. And the minute you have them tightly controlled, the system can change and then like you're back to the start. So I'm not being like overly deterministic or overly positivist, but I just like the idea of how open your variables are and how kind of tightly specified the relationships between variables are. are. And then, so for the question of like where theory is in for this, for me, it would be like, what is the sort of outcome variable? And I'm saying this as an ethnographer, I'm very comfortable saying this as an ethnographer, but like, what's sort of the outcome variable that you're looking at? So the organizational chart paper that I was telling you about, what are we trying to explain? Is it about the structure of the org chart? That's one theory. Is it about the expertise of the managers as they craft it? That's a different theory. So I think like looking at the DV kind of helps you figure out where your theory is, and then overall I'm thinking of it as kind of going from an art to a science. Loosely.
Oh yeah, yeah. So Jerry said a couple of things that I wanted to comment on. So I studied wine, I heard terroir a lot, so I love wine production. Very iconic that was in California that use a lot of technologies. And I think it offers a nice counterposition to Jerry's point that often companies or organizations that want to increase profits will have to increase efficiency, reduce costs. But I think in cultural industries, wine being the case, authenticity plays a big role in it. And the company that I studied willfully and visibly ignored and neglected certain kinds of technological inputs to demonstrate that they were doing things in a very natural, authentic way. And their wines have gotten up in price and their profits have risen. And so I think that offers a different kind of perspective of how they have been incorporated in cultural conditions.
I think it was Mark Twain who may have said, authenticity is everything. Mm-hmm. If you can fake that, you've got it made. If he didn't say that, he should have. But AI makes it pretty hard to tell what counts as authentic. Mm-hmm. Like imagine you're with 15,000 people in an airplane hangar yelling, and then suddenly someone claims none of that really happened. Mm-hmm. It was all just photos created by AI. Hypothetical, crazy example. But how do we know we're not in a simulation?
Right now, it's true.
Sort of the
Yeah, I think this was a really provocative panel. I guess I'm the last, one of the last in Amanda's class here.
Did you require them all to come?
We just like this stuff. It's all the same kind of nerd. But it sounds like, Jerry, and this is kind of a provocation bit, but it sounds like you're making an argument, like Andrew Breitbart famously said, politics downstream of culture, and it's kind of determined by battles fought in another sphere. And effectively, you're arguing that org design, I think, is downstream of sociocultural, economic, political decisions, and that those ones matter more. And so the question I guess I would ask is, if that's so true, then why study individual organizations at all? Shouldn't we be looking at large macro stuff and like relationships between forces and industries and really hack at this at the industry level instead of like, why is this a question of individual organizations if it's so organizational terroir?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I would roll. I would look at the big tectonic shifts, but like imagine you're studying, I didn't know why the Galapagos Islands were so interesting till I went there and read up on it. It's like, oh, it's because they're really separate from the mainland, but they're at the intersection of these different tides that bring in species from like the southern tip of South America, but also Asia, but also Ecuador, and they kind of mix and then battle it out, and you get these processes that happen in the Galapagos Islands. Island to island is separated. It's like, well, I want to understand, you know, the shape of this bird's beak in different places, but I need to know about the tides. I mean, I need to know the tectonic parts to make sense of why do these species evolve the way that they do. When you all study actual organizations, like I talk about that a bit. I mean, I love them both. I'd say, like, why not do both? Why not, you know, make understand what are the big shifts taking place and be sensitized to that, and antitrust law and nature of capitalism and Silicon Valley venture capital. Like, I wouldn't want to miss that. But I also wouldn't want to miss, like, you know, seeing what people at Stitch Fix are up to. And like, understanding, like, when I made this choice, when I did this thing, what was I thinking about? Was it the delight of the users? Was it my venture capitalist giving me crap about, you know, we're not meeting our quarterly goals? So I don't know. I don't know if that's an answer, but that's, I love ethnography. So
yeah, it seems like a good metaphor, right? Because you have evolution. It is interesting to look at every species, which I think is the organization, right? Every species kind of competing, adapting. What did the bird do? what did it do? Like, where did the beak come from? The beak is interesting. Galapagos is interesting, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I asked a similar question a while ago, and I can tell you the answer I got, because I kind of feel like Edwards, Braverman, and Burraway are like the most important people ever, and why does scholarship like continue? Process theory explains everything, and because it's a very macro theory, and then what's and it, but of course the state of labor process theory today is much more like helter shelter. And the person responded to me like, well, when you have those big tools, like they're too broad, they can't actually explain like the nuances of what's actually happening. Basically, you think like everything is a nail because you have a big hammer. And then, you know, and then I've sort of been linking it to why I always explain my comments about doing quant qualitative research. Quant is going to be the average, the mean, stimulus based, able bodied, white, male. And the reason we do qualitative work is for all the variants, for all the diverse things. So maybe that's where individual organizational ethnographies come in to allow us to sort of fine-tune what are those bigger macro theories that are out there.
Maybe, so one of the papers it says that give me a lab and I'll raise the world, right? There's a chapter I think you wrote, and maybe it's because I was born in Brazil and live in a very small country, Denmark. But I could realize that capitalism, antitrust laws, these decisions have been in a place, right? And we are in a very small place. You see, there's just people that you know next to you, and you can see the king or the prince or whatever, like having coffee. So you realize there's that interactions also the way to study how the students are made and how these configurations emerge. But if you comment, had a question on the back.
Yeah, thank you very much. Fascinating research. As you were talking the panel, I was just wondering, once you think about the role of mind when it comes to, and I think intentionality when it comes to design, because I think one of the things that happened in digital technology is, of course, we have big science progressively think about things, but once the white people is out there, it's starting to evolve its own thing. So I'm just wondering, can we think about design without thinking about intentionality before how is it going to be from general?
Oh, I think design is the art of the intention. It's the intent. Herb Simon said design is the intention to improve the status quo. So it's all about intention. I think you bring up a good point. Is like, at what point does the intention become somebody else's intention, and the designer doesn't have as much? They had an original intent, but they can't go beyond it. I think there's another thing that designers do, which is we're a very optimistic group where we only have, we only see the positives. We're very bad at seeing all the things that could go wrong with the design choices we're making. We don't want to ignore them, or we want to ignore them and not acknowledge them. And so every design, that this is what I went back to, every design has great intention. It always fails. Every design fails. Everything in the world, right? Bottled water. This was supposed to help us become a more hydrated society. It's ruining our oceans and other things. Everything has positive intention, but we, once it gets into a bigger system, and people don't think about the externalities that are, designers don't think about the externalities.
Can I say something rude about Juul?
Yeah, please, because I was there.
No,
and
for real?
Yeah, I've been interviewed by a lot of people now. I feel like I could have talked louder. And I did say, this could go really poorly, but I didn't say it loud enough.
So, because it feels like the perfect example of just what you said.
Yeah.
It's like the intention is these two smokers at the design school said, if only we could come up with some device to help grown-ups not smoke anymore and not be reviled by all of their peers and treated
yep.
like filthy addicts, which they were. And once it's in the hand of the Silicon Valley system, it's like, how do we sell candy-flavored vape pods to 12-year-olds? Because, you know, customer acquisition costs are low and customer lifetime value for addicts at age 12 are fantastic. Oops, like the intention was good.
The intention was good.
The outcome was disastrous.
There is I was interviewed for a New York Times piece, a video piece. If you're ever looking in your class to give a case study of things go wrong,
yeah.
they did a great video of this. And it really presents like they started off really with good intentions. And I tell a story about walking outside the door. They always used to smoke outside the product design studio, which would piss me off because I didn't want to be smoking.
So you're responsible.
I'm totally responsible. No, and I tell them, I'd be like, this is annoying. They'd be like, we're going to work on it. But then once they started working on it, I thought, ooh, this is really sexy. And this is really great. And this could be very attractive to people who do not smoke at all right now. But I wasn't in it. I was a little distance, and I was a quiet voice. So I'm in. I'm responsible.
I blame Terry Winograd.
No, oh my gosh. No, he's so far from being blamed. But I think that what could go wrong is a really, and I think this is with everything that we do. What could go wrong? We don't think about that.
I think we're going to try and wrap up. So I want to thank the panelists. We've talked a If we want to try and maybe put a little bit of a bow on our quite broad conversation, a summary might be something like the following. We talked about how everyone is being kind of sold an idea, and whether that's you as a designer with your own intention for what you think is going to happen, or you as a manager acquiring a tool, you're being sold an idea. And that idea has to resonate with your values. Mm-hmm. And as Jerry told us, our values depend on where we are located, the culture that we're embedded in, and that varies quite widely in the world. So as we think about our technologies, who's designing them? What is their intentionality? Who is buying them? Where are they located in the world? And how are they going to interpret and value them? All of this comes together and might give us quite a lot of variation in our qualitative ethnography. So we need to pay attention not just to the micro level, like we often do in our ethnography, but the macro level of where we're studying it so that we can have that contextualization. And also keep the system in mind, not just when we're thinking about what's the impact internally, but also those externalities. So thank you all for being here today. We really appreciate it. We know it's 8 a.m., but I think this, I at least was very happy with how the conversation went. So thank you all.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone.
We thank the organizers, Adrienne Baer, Amanda Pratt, and Pedro, and all the guest speakers, Ileana Stigliani, Gerald Davis, Melissa Valentine, and Elizabeth Gerber, for making this event a tremendous success. We also thank the Academy of Management for allowing us to record and present this symposium.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.